18 Celsius in the London area. For Wednesday night into Thursday, a band of cloud and rain will nudge south, weakening all the time. It means more cloud for most of us on Thursday, and again, a slightly fresher feel to things, but it's likely to stay warm and dry in the southeast, with temperatures clinging on to the high teens. That's your forecast.
Thanks, Louise. This is BBC Radio 4, where now it's time for our Book of the Week. Dejan Sutjic, director of the Design Museum in London, continues to read from his new book, B is for Bauhaus.
B is for Bauhaus began life as a dictionary, a form which was the first casualty of the digitalization of the book world. Today, I'll be looking at why chairs attract so much attention, some of my own fashion blunders, and the nature of film. C is for chair. Few objects have attracted so much attention from so many designers as the chair. Perhaps only the bicycle and the corkscrew have gone through such questionable variations, modifications, and reinventions in ever more excitable attempts to make a new and distinctive solution for a problem that has already been solved so often. It's not hard to see why designing a successful chair would appeal to a designer. To have a chair with your name attached to it confers a certain professional longevity in a way that so few categories of design make possible. To work on the design of a smartphone or a laptop is to see your efforts fade into irrelevance heartbreakingly quickly. Chairs last, both as physical objects and as designs. They continue in production for much longer than almost any other kind of industrially made artifact. Or at least they used to. A version of the Bentwood Cafe chair that Michael Thonet first made in 1859 is still in production today. The Eames lounge chair, first commercially manufactured in 1956, is still made in America and Europe, with scores of unauthorized pirated versions in China. At the end of the 1950s, Ettore Sottsass suggested that Eames had designed not so much a chair as a way of sitting. It looks as modern now as it did then. That is not something that can be claimed for two other, once equally charismatic designs from the same year, the Cadillac Coup de Ville, with its flick-up chopped tail fins, or the Raytheon 405 line black-and-white television set sitting on spindly legs. But there is evidence that the way in which we see the chair is changing too. It is being forced closer to the fashion cycle by the relentless search for novelty that has overtaken the way that design is consumed. Peter Smithson believed that the continuing charm of the chair for people who are not designers came down to its cute, anthropomorphic looks. People rarely collect cupboards or dressing tables or stools, but to collect chairs is common. It is probable that we see them as domestic pets. They have legs, feet, arms, and backs. I've never seen it quite like that. Some chairs you want to own because you want to sit on them. Others are better to look at from the other side of the room than to sit in. The chair has to be understood as a utilitarian object, and yet because it has such a long history, one that is so closely associated with so many purposes that go far beyond utility, it has also acquired cultural significance. It has come to embody power and status. The chair has also become a research testbed, putting new materials to work, from bentwood to tubular steel, fiberglass to carbon fiber, and for the shifting manufacturing techniques that they depend on. It is no wonder then that the history of modern design is so often told as a sequence of chairs rather than of cars or handguns or typefaces, all of which could be plausible candidates for the role. After carving, turning, and joining wood no longer defined the parameters of chair design, the pace changed dramatically in the 19th century, when the Thonet family transformed furniture into a fully industrial process. Michael Thonet de-skilled furniture making by investing in machinery and inventing new techniques that could produce complex shapes without craft skills. He did for furniture what McDonald's did for catering, though arguably with more culturally nourishing results. After Bentwood, chair designers worked with another newly invented material, tubular steel, which became emblematic of the machine age. In chair design terms, it had the impact of electricity on lighting. Tubular steel could be bent into tight, springy curves, supplanting the conventional one leg at each corner format for the chair. They wanted to remake familiar domestic objects in radically new forms to make a point about the modern world. They might not be able to actually build utopia, but they could at least pay a plumber to knock up something that hinted at what a utopian machine age might one day look like, with the aid of nothing much more than a few feet of gas pipe. Trying to record the evolution of contemporary design as a sequence of chairs now is like seeing history only through a close study of dynasties. There is still a lot to learn about design as a formal, technological and social issue from looking at certain chairs. But if design remains circumscribed by the chair, it will be fading into gentle irrelevance, along with such other, once vital, but now purely ornamental skills as bookbinding or iron forging. What makes design so endlessly fascinating is that it keeps shifting parameters and preoccupations. Design can be about inventing new shapes, but it doesn't have to be. It can be about objects, but it doesn't have to be. It can be about chairs, but it doesn't have to be. F is for fashion. The first item of clothing with any kind of fashion ambition that I can remember buying for myself was a corduroy tie printed with a vivid turquoise paisley pattern. It was not the kind of thing that you want to keep after its moment had passed. Nor was the 4-inch wide hipster belt with the orange and yellow zigzag stripes on its fabric inlay and a big rectangular metal buckle, or the donkey jacket, or the sharkskin print suede boots. They were the kind of thing that on a Saturday night you could add to a wardrobe based on a sensible brown tweed jacket with leather-covered buttons to make some tip of the cap towards fashion in a way that was affordable on a teenage budget and would not lead to parental ostracism. Fashion in the London of the late 1960s was a matter of social and sometimes even physical survival. It was the means to signal allegiance to the values of one tribe against the others, and so to claim its protection. For me, it was the choice between Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band and Chelsea Football Club. It was either try to look like the Beatles or sign up as a skinhead with a Ben Sherman shirt and Dr. Martin's cherry red boots. Second-hand clothes were the staple of university life. I had a Swedish Army sheepskin, which I sold when my student grant ran out, and something a far hipper student than I described as a canoe club blazer. Then came brushed denim, T-shirts with American football-style numerals, worn with desert boots that laced up to mid-calf and beyond, but were invisible under narrow-leg pink needle-cord jeans, and finally a brown velvet suit along with a pair of Art Nouveau-style cufflinks from Bieber. The jacket had the exaggerated tulip-shaped lapels of the period that certainly stood out at pub closing time in the streets of Edinburgh. F is for film. Howard Rourke is, up to a point, a plausible enough name for an architect, but I'm less convinced by Stowley Cracklight, the lard-tub protagonist of Peter Greenaway's Belly of an Architect. Gary Cooper's Rourke in King Vidor's Schlockfest, The Fountainhead, is a picture of toned muscle and angst, handy with a rock drill and brutal in his wooing of the boss's daughter when he takes a job as a day labourer in a quarry. Dennehy's Cracklight comes fully equipped with a waistline that authentically overwhelms his belt. They are both films that have always fascinated me. In the case of The Fountainhead, it's not so much Rourke, a tortured genius, that was the special attraction, although it's hard not to warm to an architect who, rather than see his work compromised by lesser talents, breaks into the building site and lays the dynamite charges to blow it up, appalled at the decorative frills that lesser hands have tacked onto the sheer walls of his thrusting tower. Even if you might not want to actually hire him, he gets your attention. But what makes The Fountainhead irresistible is that its villain-in-chief is an architecture critic. The silkily evil Ellsworth Toohey is portrayed undermining his proprietor by luring away his star columnists and inciting his readers against Rourke. If only. Cracklight, even without the same virile menace as Gary Cooper, was equally fascinating as a kind of awful warning of the worst things that can happen to a curator. I saw the film when, much like Cracklight, I was curating an architectural exhibition in Italy. In his case, it was in Rome. For me, it was the Venice Architecture Biennale, although I managed to get through the experience without being poisoned, which was more than Cracklite did, even if the undercurrents of architectural politics at the Biennale had a somewhat sinister reputation. "Be careful of the people of the lagoon," Renzo Piano told me. "On the surface, it's all sunshine. But below the water, they bite." Cinema and architecture, on and off screen, have a relationship that goes back a long way, which is both superficial and profound. Alfred Hitchcock was fascinated by architecture. He filmed it, he designed it, he evoked it. North by Northwest, a film that I can watch again and again, is full of architecture, starting with Saul Bass's titles, which begin as an abstract grid that is gradually revealed as the glazed facade of the United Nations building in Manhattan. There are other connections between film and architecture worth pursuing. They are activities that require both introversion and extroversion of their practitioners. To design a building, just as to make a film, demands a creative impulse as well as the business acumen to assemble the necessary finance and the personality to stand on a building site or a film set and impose their will on skeptical construction workers, actors, and crew. What is not always clear is the precise terms of the comparison. Is the architect playing the part of the director or of the star, the headline name that can get a development funded in the same way that signing up George Clooney can greenlight a film? It does happen occasionally when a developer looking for a degree of visibility or an easy planning consent commissions Norman Foster or Frank Gehry, and the bankers come up with a finance to build a business park or a block of flats or a skyscraper on the strength of that architect's involvement. But a more plausible analogy for the architect is with the scriptwriter, whose work is written and rewritten until everything that made it distinctive has dissolved under layer upon layer of mush. Simply because a film has an architectural theme does not necessarily mean that it will tell us much about architecture. Watching a life-size replica of the spiral at the heart of the Guggenheim Museum getting obliterated in a firestorm of automatic gunfire in the beyond dire thriller The International is more architectural product placement than spatial insight. Michael Caine's walk-on performance as an architecture professor at the beginning of Inception is no more helpful as an insight into the mother of the arts than the random job description of Woody Harrelson's character as an architect in Indecent Proposal. Hollywood producer Joel Silver, who collects Frank Lloyd Wright houses the way some people collect vintage cars, represents the blockbuster end of the depiction of architectural space. In the first two Die Hard franchises, he took his audience deep into the entrails of skyscrapers and airports to demonstrate how buildings and complex spaces work, drawing a much less two-dimensional portrait of them than he achieved with his human character, played by Bruce Willis. Some films can capture a shift in architectural mood even before architects are aware of it. Blade Runner really did detonate an interest in dystopia and an exploration of the city of the future as messy and dark, with machines dripping steam and backstreet DNA analysts. It became the subject of conferences at architecture schools around the world. It's not the film name checks or the plot lines that can really tell us something new about architecture. Of course, there is a certain narcissistic flutter when Maria Schneider in Antonioni's The Passenger makes her appearance as an architecture student. But the real architectural quality of that film is in the climactic, uninterrupted 7-minute continuous take that begins inside Jack Nicholson's hotel room in southern Spain, moves round the room and through the window to make a circuit of the square outside. This is the kind of magic that architects always wish they could work, but their buildings are static and they can't impose their viewpoint on the people who experience their buildings, though it doesn't stop them from trying.
Dejan Sujic is reading from his new book, B is for Bauhaus. The book is abridged by Polly Coles, produced by Clive Brill, and it's a Pacificus production for BBC Radio 4. This is BBC Radio 4. It's 12 minutes to 1. Now here's the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 today, Wednesday the 16th of April. There are warnings of gales in Viking, North Utsira, Faroes and Southeast Iceland. The general synopsis at 1800. High Humber, 1032, expected Germany, 1030 by 1800 Wednesday. Low Denmark Strait, 987, expected southern Iceland, 999 by same time. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Viking. Southerly, 5 to 7, occasionally gale 8 in the far northeast. Fair, then rain, good, becoming moderate or poor. North Utsira. Southerly, 5 to 7, occasionally gale 8 in the far north. Fair, then rain, good, becoming moderate. South Utsira.